He's a good doctor, I think, you know. I told him I get heartburn sometimes, so he goes and gets me a list of things that cause heartburn. I'm looking at the list and I'm like, I already know this. I know how to get it. That's like going into the hospital with a cannonball wound and they show you a list. Here's how you get cannonball wounds.
Are you all right, pal? You sure?
What kind of weird competitive freak are you?
It's a hormonal imbalance. Testosterone, the male hormone, dominates the female body. It's kind of scary. You come home, mommy, how you feeling?
Not bad today. The beard's coming in nice.
You sure I'm worth it?
Yeah.
There's a couple of things that we were hoping that you'd help us with.
Yes. Like, where does the water go in the iron?
And what's the iron for?
And what gets out Kool-Aid stains?
Yeah, we already know that the opposite color Kool-Aid doesn't work.
Also, Troy scraped me when we were fork jousting last week, and I don't think it's healing right.
Oh, ew. Abed, that's infected.
Infected, that's the word I was looking for.
She gets hot flashes and cold flashes. If she gets a hot flash and walks into a cold room, she can make it rain.
Sing along, Doc.
I think that's quite enough. You are a doctor after all.
Hospital food.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Wednesday House Call. 10 after 3, News Talk Radio, 580 CFRA. Ron Corbin sitting in for Rob this afternoon. Dr. Barry Dworkin here with me in the Hal Anthony studio. We will be taking your calls for the next hour. 521-8255, 521-TALK. Main number here at the studio. If you have a question for Dr. Dworkin, give us a shout. Star 580. Let me give you all the numbers. 1-800-580-CFRA, 580-2372. We are taking calls now. Jenny McCarthy coming to town, Dr. Dworkin. Yeah, you're a fan, right?
Yeah, woohoo.
Yeah, you're a fan, are you not, of Jenny McCarthy and her medical expertise?
That's right, yeah. Her 0 years of medical school training, that's right. Yeah.
To explain for listeners who may not be following this story, she's here for a fundraiser. The Canadian Regional Cancer Center, Ottawa Regional Cancer Center. They're bringing her in for a fundraiser. Now, she is very controversial, Jenny McCarthy.
Yeah, she's controversial and wrong, too. So
controversial and wrong.
Jenny McCarthy, as you know, was the proponent of measles vaccine causing autism hoax.
Yes.
Which was completely refuted. The paper that originally was published was retracted because of falsified data. The physician that wrote this, Andrew Wakefield, was disbarred from the British Medical Society and is still trying to peddle this type of hypothesis around without any evidence whatsoever. The problem with this whole episode, which started in 1998, is that there have been hundreds, if not thousands, of children now documented to have contracted measles. Primarily, you see that in France and European countries and in spots in North America. Japan was another big one where this happened, where you had these large, and I mean large measles outbreak of 10, 20, 30,000 children. And measles is a neurological disease. Measles will damage the brain. It will cause sometimes permanent damage. It's not just a rash with a fever. It can cause significant damage. And the problem has been that vaccination rates dropped because of these stories. And because the vaccination rates dropped, countless hundreds of children have been hurt by this information or false information. So frankly, I hold her in some ways responsible for propagating this particular story and accountable for the harm that has happened to children.
So you're surprised that she has been invited for a medical fundraiser?
I think what happens with this, they have stated they've brought her in because she's funny, she's energetic, she's vivacious, quoting what they've said. And there are lots of people that are like that, that don't espouse those views. This is for a cancer fundraiser, which is to invest in not only treatments and information for patients, prevention of disease, but also to invest in the science of trying to find how to help out these people. Mm-hmm. And in so doing, you're inviting someone who has been anti-science, anti-vaccination, and essentially legitimizing that point of view. And they may say, well, we're not having her here because of that. But by recognizing her and bringing her here, you are legitimizing that in the eyes of the public.
Okay. Well, I think they're getting a bit of a backlash on this one, so it'll be interesting to follow this story over the next couple of days. Now, Dr. Dworkin is here to answer your medical questions. If you have a question for Dr. Dworkin, again, I'll give you the main number here at the studio, 521-8255, 521-TALK, main number here. If you have a question for Dr. Dworkin, we will be taking your calls for the next hour until 4 o'clock, star 580, and the toll-free number, 1-800-580-CFRA, 580-2372. If you have any sort of question, any sort of medical question for Dr. Dworkin. We were talking about a study just before we got on the air as well.
Right.
A diet study over in Spain.
Mm-hmm. This particular study, which is now making the rounds, essentially was saying that depending on when you eat, these were 420 people, average age 42, with a body mass index of 31, normal is between 20 and 25. So clinically, they were diagnosed as being obese and class one obesity in terms of the stages. And they were given randomized. Half of them were eating before 3 o'clock in the afternoon and the other half were eating after in terms of the bulk of their food.
Bulk of their
but 40% of their intake, caloric intake, was time dependent. And they found that after 20 weeks, these 420 Spanish people, age 42, body mass index of 31, with a very restricted type of diet where they were monitored. The group that ate earlier in the day lost 22 pounds in those 20 weeks, and the group that ate after 3 o'clock in the afternoon lost 17 pounds. So they both lost weight.
A five-pound difference.
Five-pound difference. So the conclusions that are being drawn from this is that when you eat may play a part in how much weight you lose. But there are difficulties with this because your population was very specific. The time frame for your study was quite short, 20 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
We know that bodies adapt to all kinds of situations over time. So you don't know how at the end of a year, if you do this for a year, whether both groups would have lost the same amount of weight. It's unclear if that's the case, whether this type of pattern of eating is sustainable for somebody who's in that situation. Again, this was a controlled study, right? So you were able to control for those factors. And whether it's even applicable to people in North America, because these were Spanish people with maybe their dietary habits, their culture's a bit different, their genetics could be a bit different. So you can't claim causality with this. All you can say is that we need to now look and see if there is some sort of metabolic clock involved that might promote better weight loss depending on when you eat. But the bottom line is that you shouldn't jump on any study, one study or many studies, as a means of determining what you should do. The only way to really know whether something is applicable is something called a systematic review. And a systematic review is when you take good quality studies that fit criteria for what constitutes a well-conducted study, and you ask a specific question. So in this question, it would be, does eating before 3 o'clock in the afternoon promote weight loss? And you have to then pull through all these studies, aggregate them together, and then come up with an answer. And that's where you'll get, it's averaging out, in other words. And it gives you an idea of whether this is clinically relevant or not. And there is a group that does this. It's called the Cochrane Collaboration, which is an independent research organization comprised of hundreds, if not thousands, of researchers that do this very job, unbiased, not paid by any companies. It's a nonprofit organization, and they do this. They even print up really easy graphs for people to understand what's going on.
Barry, just before we take our first caller, what's interesting about this study, and you mentioned it, everybody's picked it up. Every newswire has now picked this story up, and people across around the world have been reading this story. So, you know, by the end of today, there's going to be this conventional wisdom, quick one-day conventional wisdom that this is true, that it depends. You could lose more weight, but depending upon what time of the day you eat.
And
when,
people
as you
will
say,
use,
it's a small study.
Yeah, people use anecdotal evidence.
Fat people in Spain.
Yeah, your study population has to be reflective of everybody, and that's not reflective of everybody.
So you need more.
And you need many more people involved in order to get anything powerful out of these studies. 420 people who are overweight to that extent,
Yeah.
And as you said, a very local area.
I'm not being flippant there, but a very local specific area.
That's right.
Area.
So
their diet, there could be all sorts of
that's
factors.
That's right. So it only raises questions, which is fine, but you can't then apply that and say, this is what we must do.
Yeah. Okay. 521-8255, 521-TALK. If you have a question for Dr. Dworkin, are things starting to slow down a bit at the clinic with the flu and the colds?
Well, the flu and the colds were mainly just in addition to the regular stuff that we see. So the clinic is always busy. It's not a matter of the flu adding a lot more. It's just that it was in addition to what we normally would see anyway. And again, in our clinical setting, it's well, child care, baby care, hypertension, cancers, lung disease, kidney disease, diabetes, weight, people overweight, depressions, mood disorders. I mean, that's the stuff that you see every day.
Now, you're not a big fan of using cold medicine. People have a cold.
Right.
A cold is very different from a flu. I want to say that right up. But you're not a big fan of using cold medicines, these nighttime and daytime cold medicines.
No, for the most part, our bodies will get rid of a cold on their own. In fact, they always do, unless you have some underlying chronic disease process that will get exacerbated or worsened by the cold. But for the most part, if you're not feverish, if you don't have a headache, you might be congested a bit, big deal.
Okay.
There's no reason to take medications for stuff like that if you don't have to.
We're going to go to Tom now. Tom has a question for us about... good afternoon, Tom.
Good afternoon, sir. Good afternoon, doctor. Oh,
hi, I'm fine. How are you?
You're looking well.
Thanks.
I'm telling you, sir, I phoned you a while back. Remember about dry mouth?
Yes.
And I got a thing there from the, from the internet, but from the drugstore.
Yeah.
And it says one in every five adults got this problem.
Uh-huh.
And I have it really bad. It's only at nighttime when I'm sleeping.
Right. I remember you talking about that.
No,
okay, can I jump in the conversation? What is dry mouth? Sorry.
What the hell causes it?
Well, with dry mouth, the issue is, so your mouth gets really pasty, right? Like nothing, there's no saliva, there's nothing in it?
Only at nighttime, during the day, I'm all right.
Now, is it nighttime while you're sleeping or nighttime?
Yeah, while I'm sleeping.
Yeah.
I have to wake up and I have to gargle and drink a lot of water then.
Yeah, and usually what tends to happen, I think we discussed this before, was that
the only problem I got now, maybe I should put duct tape on my mouth.
Well, you have to, did you get the humidifier for your room?
Yeah, I got it, but it doesn't seem to work.
Right next to the bed?
Yep.
And it's the cool mist one?
It's the cool mist, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, because
I used to keep the window closed, and I had that closed.
Yeah, because I think you said that you tend to breathe through your mouth when you're sleeping.
Well, I don't know, because I'm asleep, I don't know.
I know. You got to get a little video camera, Tom, to find out.
It's just awful dry. It's like the Sahara Desert.
Yeah, and again, if this was a disease, that is, if it was something that was causing your salivary glands to stop producing saliva and preventing your mouth from being lubricated, you would expect to see this throughout the day. So the fact that it's happening at night would usually point to more of an environmental influence. That is, again, a lot of people tend to breathe through their mouths when they are...
Yeah, just say I'm sleeping with my mouth open.
And it's for the same reason, for example, when people are in hospital and on oxygen and they have a mask and they tend to be breathing through their mouths, they have to humidify the oxygen because otherwise they get too dry. And so what can be happening, again, even though you have the humidifier, it still may be too dry in the room. And also there are limitations to what these things can do, especially if it's hours and hours of breathing through your mouth, and it can cause, again, your mouth to dry out. Sometimes all you can do really is to have water by the bedside to try to drink a little bit if it wakes you up, in order to sort of lubricate that. There are also some oral lubricants that can be used from time to time that can also help alleviate some of that dryness. But I think it's an uphill battle for you, Tom.
I know it is, because it's a thing they're called BIOTENE. Biotene?
Yes.
Yeah, they got a lot of those. I tried a lot of them. They're no good.
Usually these over-the-counter stuff is not going to be... Yeah.
We're right out of time, Tom. Tom, listen, thanks very much for phoning in.
Anyway, I don't know, doctor. I wonder what the hell am I going to do. I'm out during the day. Yeah. Maybe I have to keep my mouth shut.
Well, Tom.
I love this guy.
God, he just stole my line there.
He's
Tom,
so good.
Tom, you take care. We're going to have to run.
All right, Tom.
You're waiting to get on to speak with Dr. Dworkin. I'm going to ask you, please be patient. 521-8255. 521-TALK if you want to grab a line.
I tried the Subway diet because I'm on the road 35, 40 weeks a year, and there's a Subway everywhere. And Subway's pretty good, but that Jared guy, he went every day for a year. Were you stalking a girl behind the counter? I tried it. I went every day for a month. Every day, I went to Subway. After about 2 weeks, alarm clock would ring, and I go, oh God, I wonder what I'm gonna have for lunch today. Jeez. After a month, I lost weight. I also lost my will to live. I burnt out on Subway. I'd still go to Subway. If I was starving in the desert and I saw a Subway, I'd go, wow, well, let's walk a little further. We can come back if we have to.
Welcome back to Wednesday House Calls. Ron Corbett sitting in for Rob this afternoon. Dr. Barry Dworkin here with me in the studio taking your calls this afternoon. 521-8255, 521-TALK. If you have a question for Barry, let's go to Marie, phoning us from Ottawa this afternoon. Good afternoon, Marie.
Hi.
Hi.
I just had a quick call for our question. I've been diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis, but I still exercise pretty regularly, about an hour and a half, 5 or 6 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
However, and I was having issues with my thyroid. It wasn't overly low, but it was low. My doctors put me on thyroid medication. I'm only taking 0.05 micrograms daily. But since September, and this has happened in the past, I've gained 40 pounds. I eat very healthy because I have food allergies, so not a lot of processed or prepared foods.
Mm-hmm.
And despite all the exercise, I wake up absolutely exhausted. Every time she increases the dose of my thyroid, I feel good for about a week, and I, you know, drop a few pounds, but then it just goes right back. So I'm not sure what to do at this point. I don't want to keep increasing the thyroid medication if that's not what's doing it. I got a cortisone shot for the first time in 6 months for the rheumatoid arthritis and immediately gained 10 pounds from that about 2 weeks ago. So I'm at 210 when I was at 180 just 4 or 5 months ago, and I'm not sure what to do about it and getting quite frustrated.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think what has to happen is if the thyroid blood tests that are done show that you have normal thyroid hormone. There are different measurements that can be taken, right? There's usually the two that are used are one is called TSH, which is thyroid stimulating hormone. That's the hormone produced by the brain to tell your thyroid to make hormone. And usually if that level is very elevated, it means that you don't have much thyroid hormone being produced because it's literally screaming at the thyroid gland, come on, start making some.
Yeah.
And then the other is called T4.
Yeah.
Or free T4, and that's the actual thyroid hormone. And if the T4 level is normal, then you're having enough of that medication. So that being said, if there is weight gain, unexplained weight gain, despite a normally functioning thyroid gland, then it may indicate that there are other metabolic processes going on that are responsible. So there are other blood tests that can be done to look at various other hormonal systems. So,
like the adrenal glands,
and that kind of thing. Yeah. Thinking of Cushing's disease there are tests that are done for that. It may require seeing an endocrinologist to try and determine what the cause is, especially if your food intake has been the same. There's been no change in your intake and you're gaining weight. It means that whatever you're metabolizing is working at a slower rate.
Yeah. Because I find like there have been a couple of times where I get like these very bad dizzy spells, especially when I stand up and it means I can't drive or something like that. Then I'll be in bed for about 2 weeks and I'll drop in 2 weeks like 20, 30 pounds just from being in bed all that time. And then, you know, things go back to normal. I start exercising again and whatnot and the weight slowly increases.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think it requires, part of the issue is that once a diagnosis is made, there's a tendency just to hold on to that diagnosis and not look any further. So I think it may be helpful to have that discussion with your physician about looking at potential other, what we call differential diagnoses. That is an, a list of other diagnoses that could potentially explain this so that at least you're having the workup done to answer some of those questions.
Okay. I'm seeing my doctor actually tomorrow evening. So other than possibly because she, like you said, has been a little bit resistant at looking at other diagnoses. So other than like, you know, looking at cortisol levels and whatnot for the adrenal glands, what other things should I may possibly be suggesting?
Well, again, if there is this continued weight gain and there it is. I mean, it is a metabolic workup, so that's essentially what it is. So it is various hormones, hormone levels that can be taken from the pituitary gland to see if that's causing a problem, from the adrenal glands themselves, looking at cortisol levels. The timing of these tests is important, too. So, for example, when taking cortisone, they usually want to see cortisol levels. They want to see it just in the morning. It's usually 8 a.m. in the morning, and they'll usually advise you when to come in for those tests, but it's a long list of things. So it's just mainly it would fall under the heading of a metabolic or endocrine workup in order to evaluate that.
There you go.
And also also in case of there are other medications that you're taking, depending if there are others, they also may be responsible for some of the side effects as well.
Okay, Marie, I hope that helps and good luck with your doctor's appointment tomorrow. Let's go to Cumberland now. Let's welcome James to the show. Good afternoon, James.
Hello.
Hi.
I had a, I think they call it a TERP.
Yes.
9th of January.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still bleeding, and I'm wondering how long to expect to keep bleeding.
Well, the issue is whenever there is, the surgery done for the prostate was essentially removing quite a section of it, and it is going to bleed a bit. What can be misleading is that with bleeding and when you urinate, is it blood that you see just coming out or when you're urinating that there's blood?
When I'm urinating.
Yeah.
And usually right at the start.
Right. And so what tends to, and it's at right at the start because there's blood that collects in the prostate gland. And then as you start to urinate, the blood passes through and just pushes it through. So what you'll tend to, what tends to be quite frightening for people is when they see it all red, it's difficult though to determine the degree of bleeding because it only takes a little bit of blood to make everything red. So it can actually appear to be more bleeding than is actually happening. The way to determine whether the bleeding is profound or not is a blood test just to check what we call hemoglobin levels and that or red blood cell levels. And this will tell us exactly whether there's been a lot of blood loss or not. That being said, usually you're looking for a prostate gland. It heals relatively slowly. Usually you see things like this at least 4 to 6 weeks after surgery.
Yeah.
You still have some bleeding. But again, it could be even just a few drops from the prostate that can make the urine turn quite red. There can also be little clots in there that when you start to urinate, it disrupts them and you end up seeing that initial amount that comes out at first.
So likely nothing for James to worry
about. The issue is, though, to be absolutely sure would be first to... You can also bring a urine sample in to have that looked at, but also to what's called a CBC done to really detect whether there is a lot of bleeding. Usually you do a blood pressure on somebody too if they're bleeding a lot. But if you're bleeding profoundly from that gland, it would be really dark red blood dripping out. I mean, it wouldn't just stop just when you're urinating because the gland would collect and the blood would flow through.
Yeah.
So it likely is because the gland has been wounded, right? It has been cut.
Yeah.
You are going to have some bleeding. But for peace of mind, sometimes what's very helpful is again, just to see your physician, discuss that. And they may want to do a blood test. And if the hemoglobin is close to what it was before your surgery, at least you know that the bleeding is, it's not a lot of bleeding, that it's just, it will eventually stop. It just takes that time to heal up.
Does that help you, James?
Yeah, it seems to be... getting less most of the time.
Right.
Then it'll start again and stop again.
Yeah, and that's very normal. The prostate gland takes a lot of time to heal up.
James, thanks very much for phoning in. Good luck with that, sir.
You're welcome.
Yeah. I'd be a little bit nervous about that as well.
Well, whenever you see blood, I mean,
exactly.
But it is something that can make you think that there's more than what there actually is because it just mixes in and colors it red.
We're going to go up to Renfrew now. Let's welcome Patrick to the show. Patrick, good afternoon.
Oh, hello, gentlemen.
Hi.
I have a problem. My daughter's 20. She's a university student down there in Ottawa U.
Mm-hmm.
And she, over the holidays, ended up in ICU in Renfrew for 4 days with a hole in her lung. She's very petite. And anyway, it seemed to fix itself. And then a week after in university, she had to be rushed off to the hospital to the general.
Mm-hmm.
And he took off the top part of her one lung. Is that going to be a complication time to come, or what? Is this going to keep coming back, these holes?
So did she have what they call a pneumothorax?
I, quite honest with you, sir, I couldn't tell you.
Okay, because usually what you tend, person presents with a sudden shortness of breath or difficulty breathing.
Her chest was filling up with oxygen. I thought she was going to die on the way to the hospital.
Yeah, so that's a pneumothorax. That's where the lung, there's a part of the lung that just breaks open, and the air in the lung actually goes into the space between the lung and the rib cage.
Yeah, and she couldn't even breathe barely.
Right, and the air accumulates in the rib cage and compresses the lung.
Mm-hmm.
Usually what they're called spontaneous, it's called spontaneous pneumothorax, and they're sometimes they don't even know why it happens. The other times there can be connective tissue diseases that can do that. I'm sure they've done a bunch of testing to be able to evaluate that. Did they do an open surgery to remove the lung? Is that what happened?
They went into the side with a couple of holes in the camera.
Yeah.
And they took, I think, an inch and a half of one of her lungs off.
Okay, so they likely found that area of the lung was either defective or something that would make it more likely to break again.
Yeah, where Renfrew had left it, they said sometimes to heal up.
Correct, and you don't want to do surgery unless it's absolutely necessary. The bottom line, though, is that with the removal of a part of the lung, there's a lot of redundancy in the lung. So it's the top part, it's unlikely to stop her from having a normal active life. Because it's the lung, there was literally the area of two tennis courts in terms of air transfer, surface area for air transfer in your lung. So you have a lot of redundancy. So removing that little bit is unlikely to affect her over the long term.
But now, is that prevalent in skinny little girls and boys?
It can happen in anybody. There are certain subtypes of people where that can happen, but it's a relatively rare event. So it makes it more difficult to determine why this actually happened with her, but it's, you know, I would imagine that they're going to do stuff in order to see if there was any. Usually, you look for things called connective tissue diseases. So, was there anything that attacked the lung? Anything with her immune system that attacked the lung, or inflammatory process that led to it? Was there any infection in there that wasn't detected that led to it?
Yeah.
So, it is something that happens. It's unfortunate that it happens, but the good thing is that it's curable, right? I mean, you treat it and people get better.
I feel sorry for
Patrick. But it happens all of a sudden. You don't know what happens, yeah.
Yeah, he must have. He must be losing sleep over the past month. Mm. Well, there you go, Patrick. It looks like everything's going to be okay. I want to thank you very much for phoning in. We have time for one more, I think, quickly, if we go to Winchester. Chris. Good afternoon, Chris.
Hi.
Listen, I've got this interesting sort of symptom. I've got like a pressure. It's almost like a crown around my head. It seems to start at the temples beside the eyes and run back along the skull on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
The doctor, my family physician and my chiropractor have been looking into it. They've indicated that there's a little bit of a loss of curve in the neck, and the chiropractor has been treating it that way. It doesn't seem to be making an improvement. The family doctor, the general practitioner, has done blood work and so on, and it doesn't seem to be coming back irregularly. I have this theory, though. I travel a lot for work. I've been away in my, I have two teeth on the top of my jaw that seem to be in line with this sort of pressure that I'm having. It comes up from the jawline and all the way across. And both of those teeth are affected with a cavity that I had to treat with Amoxil when I was away.
Mm-hmm.
Pain never returned, and this has been 2 months. And over the next month, I'm going to have those teeth repaired.
Now, the pain. Wonder,
could they be releasing toxins or causing some sort of pressure that would create this sort of this pressure? It feels like I have a mask or like somebody's pushing with their hands on the side of my head.
Well, there's a couple of things that can do that. I mean, one is if you have anything with your jaw, especially where the jaw meets up with the skull, and if there is any instance of a grinding or tightening your mouth when you're sleeping, you can have situations where pain will radiate up to the area of the temples and sometimes around the head. It's called temporomandibular joint syndrome, and it is quite painful. One of the ways to diagnose it is when the person opens their mouth and you press on the jaw joint from behind, you can have pain that's recreated that way. It can be worse at night, but it can be also painful during the day. again, if blood tests have been normal, usually you're looking for connective tissue diseases or arterial diseases that can sometimes give you pain around the temples. If that was normal, that's a good thing. The main thing is not to get stuck on one area. So I'm glad that he's talking about teeth, and the teeth are not going to release any toxins in the area to make anything hurt. But it certainly can be a structural thing as well. So it's you would have to have that when your dentist looks at it to look and see if your teeth enamel has been grinded down, because that'll tell you whether you're grinding your teeth or not.
Something the dentist look at.
And also to look at that joint.
We are right out of time, Chris. Thanks very much for phoning in. Doctor, pleasure as always.
Likewise.
We'll see you at the Jenny McCarthy Show.
All right.